to Sister Little. It is true that our brother Malcolm X is gone, but he alerted us that every shut eye ain't sleep and every goodbye ain't gone. One of our previous speakers was speaking of the mother of a giant. And that is so accurate. It is also accurate to say that she was the giant of a mother. She was a woman forced under harsh circumstances to take her family and do the best that she could. The forces against her were enormous, especially in those days. Trying to be a black woman in one of the most racist parts of America at one of its most racist times and raise children, healthy children, it's almost impossible to do it today. However, the seeds that were planted are good seeds. I'm looking at Grenada. It is so green here. I was told that if you just take a plant, a seed of any type, and throw it like that, you come back tomorrow and it's a tree. Well, I don't know about that, but I will tell you all that I did throw a mango pit somewhere over there. Now, when I come back here next year, I don't want to see you eating my mangoes. It is good to be together here. It's good that we are in a place where we are at the anniversary, 100 years of Malcolm. Imagine that. 100 years. When his enemies fired their weapons, they thought that was the end of the story. They just knew that they ended that. And I don't just mean the folk who fired the weapons. I also mean the agencies that sent him. They just knew that that was the end of this Malcolm story. Well, to them, we alert them that Malcolm is our seed, that they planted him, but as a seed, he is growing, and his children are sprouting all over. To the Institute of the Black World, y'all keep on doing what you're doing. That was a mighty prayer that you prayed. And it only by prayer you got here, Brother Ron, and that you kept us here. To all of us gathered here together, we do need to have our charge. And our charge is to go back to the highways and the byways, to go back to the ignorance, to go back to all of those who are walking in darkness, and to say that there is light, and the light is good, and they should walk in the light. Having said those things, my friends, it is so beautiful here, but there are speakers better than I will ever be, and they're coming up behind me. It is with a great reluctance that I leave all of this greenness, and I'm praying that I'm going back to someplace warm. But if I could just ask the good people of Grenada, could y'all bottle some of this heat so I can take it up north, because sometimes it's cold up there, but the warmth of your spirits warm us. Thank you very much. Forward ever, backwards never.
Thank you so much, Senator. He's literally leaving from here straight to the airport, so thank you so much for being here. As always. So now we're going to move into the part of the program where we'll have some solidarity statements. Among the delegation, we have representation from some amazing movements in the United States of America, some great black diasporic movements. And so we're so happy to have you here among us. And so we're going to call representation from each of those movements to be here. We're going to start with SIS, Ms. Monifa Bandeli. She will be representing the Malcolm X grassroots movement and Movement for Black Lives. We're so happy to have you here. Come on up and have the stage with us.
Thank you so much, everyone. I am so excited to be here and honored to be here amongst not only the delegation that I arrived with, but the people of Grenada. So first off, I want to say that I am here representing the Movement for Black Lives, which is over 150 Black-led organizations from all over the United States. We all want to thank the people of Grenada for your fierce commitment to the Black world and for your history of modeling sovereignty, self-determination, steadfast development, and growth in the face of threats local and abroad, and bringing and birthing one of the most fierce leaders of our time, Maurice Bishop. We thank you, Grenada. Our movements are across borders, they are across generations, and they are interconnected. We know that the work we do today is built on the work of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, it's built on Maurice Bishop, and it's built on Malcolm X, and it's built on Louise Langdon Little. And our modern day movement in the United States, we are working day in and day out to smash the vestiges of slavery, which is our modern day incarceration system. We call ourselves abolitionists. And we fight against the criminalization of Black people at home and abroad, because we know that it's used as a tool for our oppression here, and also to prevent us from connecting to our brothers and sisters around the world because of the stories and the narratives that they create to criminalize and to separate us. But we know that together, which all the ancestors that I named have taught us, that together, not only will we smash the vestiges of slavery throughout the African diaspora, we will smash the vestiges of colonialism that currently keep us back today. And in smashing those systems, we want to be clear, because in the Movement for Black Lives, we don't just talk about blocking, we also talk about building. We don't just talk about divesting, we talk about investing. And we know that when we work together with our brothers and sisters from around the diaspora, we can actually build and actualize the visions of Marcus Garvey, the visions of Louise Langdon Little, the visions of Maurice Bishop, the visions of Malcolm X. It is on us to bring those visions to a reality, and the only way that we can do it is as a united Black world. Thank you so much for having me here. We are inspired by Grenada.
Next, we'd like to call Mr. Charles Mitchell from the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee. Mr. Mitchell.
Blessings. Hotep Africans, where Brooklyn at? We not bougie now. Where Brooklyn at? Where's Jamaica at? Where's Trinidad at? Where's Grenada at? That's what I'm talking about. We are African people, and we can take pride in the individual islands or the boroughs that we come from, but we need to understand that we are Africans, first and foremost. I asked these young people to come up. One young man, his name is Kyrie. He's actually from Malcolm's family, which I didn't know when I asked him to come up. And one young sister, Talika. Oh, here, you say your name.
Tamika.
Say it again, say it loud.
Tamika.
Tamika, you say your name.
Kyrie.
I asked them to come up here because we need to make this real for them. Not just asking them to stand up back there somewhere to pull them into the history that they're witnessing. Too often I go to these events and I see young people bored and distracted and looking at their cell phones. They need to be a part of this, because one day I expect you, Kyrie, and you, Talik, to be up here leading our people. Yes, don't look at me like I'm crazy. One day you're going to be up here leading our people. And if you're not leading our people, you're going to be leading your children. And so when we honor Louise Langdon Norton Little on this site for her son's 100th birthday anniversary, we need to make it clear that we are not just honoring her as a mother, as the person who birthed Malcolm X. We are honoring her for her own genius. For her own genius. This is her soil. Malcolm was not born here. She was born here. So we have to give her extra special love for what she contributed to the UNIA, to her family, and to the communities in America and Canada and other places in which she did her work. Her work, not Malcolm's work, her work. Too often when we speak of our sisters, we only honor them for being mothers or being in a particular field. We don't never really honor the sisters for their greatness in helping our people. So we have to speak that into these children, especially this young man right here who's in her family and doesn't quite know how he ties and connects to her, especially to this young lady who was on the soil that Malcolm's mother was on. And yet she may not know her full story and be inspired by her. I have the honor of being here as a member of the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee, which was formed by Herman Ferguson, Ialua Ferguson, Yuri Kochiyama, and so many others that actually worked with Malcolm X. I have the honor of being here as a member of the Sons of Africa, who every year, and this year will be the 60th year since Malcolm was assassinated, and we've been doing this. We gather around the grave of Malcolm X to honor him. So it is especially an honor for me to be able to also honor his mother on the site in which she was born and nurtured by her family. We need to make this real for us. We need to make this real for our next generations. We need them to understand that our struggle is not just a struggle for Grenada. It's not just a struggle for Jamaica or Trinidad and Tobago or Carriacou. Our struggle is a struggle for all African people. And when we all win, we will all be free to be self-determined. We will all be free to control the politics, the economics, and the culture of the communities and the nations in which we are the majority peoples. That's what she taught her son. That's where she lived her life, doing the work in the UNIA, teaching our people and organizing our people around. So Malcolm didn't get that from the Nation of Islam. I don't care what they tell you. Malcolm got that from the teachings that were instilled in him by Louise Langdon Norton Little and Earl Little, and that were instilled in them by their parents and grandparents that preceded them. And so we need to speak that same life into these young people, that is not just about going to get an education. It's not just about going to get an education. It's not just about going to get an education to better yourself. Your job in getting that education, yes, is to better yourself and to be able to take care of your family, but it's also to contribute to freeing African people and providing businesses. If you're a nurse, speaking up for them in the healthcare system. If you're a teacher, speaking up for them in the education system. If you're a politician, being a real servant leader to our people. That is the tradition in which Louise Langdon Norton Little lived and taught her children and taught Malcolm. And Malcolm taught that to the brothers and sisters in the nation. The things that we give credit to Elijah Muhammad to, they weren't speaking the same language that Malcolm was speaking it to. He taught them. And that influence of his mother still lives on in the ministers and other folks that Malcolm taught. So let's get it clear. She gets all the honor and the glory. And Earl Little get all the honor and the glory. Amen? Yes. Amen? Yes. Ashe, family. Hotep.
Thank you, Charles. Next, would like to invite Ms. Shamika Simpson. She came all the way from Omaha, Nebraska, as a senior policy advisor for the Malcolm X Memorial Foundation. We are happy to have you here, sis. Come share the mic with us.
Hello, good people. Thank you for having us here. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, which is actually the birthplace of Malcolm X. He was born at 3448 Pinckney Street, which is right down the street from where we stay. His mother, Louise Langdon Little, was there in Omaha, Nebraska with her husband, Earl Little, as representatives of the UNIA, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. They had came to Omaha, Nebraska to set up a delegation. She was also a writer of the newspaper, The Negro World. And when she birthed Malcolm in Omaha, she birthed him there in the midst of hate, in the midst of poverty, in the midst of suffering, but also in the midst of great love. Miss Little herself was a visionary. She was a prophetess. She knew when her husband was going to die. She warned him ahead of time not to go, and he did anyway. Miss Little was a woman who spoke many languages. And so when she was the writer of the Negro World, she was able to actually interpret that into more than one language. So she had the gift of tongues. She had the gift of vision. She had the gift of being able to teach her children what was most important. And what was most important was not money. What was most important was not fame or glory. Once again, not too many people knew who she was because Earl Little, her husband, was a minister who would travel. And they knew him but didn't know her, but she was the backbone of everything that made Malcolm X who he was. In January of 1925, the year that Malcolm X was born, the KKK, which is the Ku Klux Klan, a hate group that was sent to kill and oppress and suppress United States citizens who were trying to lift their race, they actually chased Malcolm X and his family out of Omaha. While she was pregnant with Malcolm in Omaha, Nebraska in 1925 in a cold wintry month, they came and they threatened her and her family with death because they didn't like the work that they were doing there. It is because of that Malcolm only was allowed to stay in Omaha for 2 years. He ended up having to leave because they thought that they would be killed because of the hatred and the racism that they faced in Omaha. So we appreciate the fact that Louise Langdon, even though she came from here, Grenada, she was able to bring a piece of herself, of that freedom fighting spirit, to Omaha. And she birthed a seed in Omaha, Nebraska that can never be cut down, a tree that has grown into something that we can see its leaves and its fruit populate till this day. So we appreciate, once again, the Grenadian people sharing Louise with us. And we appreciate Omaha, Nebraska being able to be that incubating home that grew Malcolm's seed into the tree of life and liberty that he represents for us. Thank you all.
At this time, I would like to welcome Kim Poole. She will be doing a cultural expression, and she will also be reading a solidarity statement, and I'll let her introduce who the statement is from.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home. And I start with that song because when they asked me to speak and say a few words about Louise Langdon Little, I didn't feel qualified. I said there should be somebody in La Digue, Grenada, that speaks on behalf of Mama Louise Langdon Little. See, when we're back in Baltimore or in New York or doing our Zooms and your voice is not there, sure, I'll tell you what I know about this mama. But when we go back to Grenada, I want to be a student. I want to sit at the feet of her lineage, direct bloodline that's still there, those that are safeguarding this knowledge. But then I remembered that she understood the fear of what it means to be a black woman living in the context of a white world, afraid that her children won't make it. I understood, and I reminded myself that she understood what it meant to have the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, surround her house where her husband had been killed and have to stand toe to toe with them, just like my mother and my grandmother and my grandmother's grandmother. You see, Mama Louise Langdon Little is unique because she is all of our mother. She is our Pan-African mother of the entire diaspora. She can relate to us all. She lived all of our experiences. And so when I stand here today to read the statement from a president, you see, we have a Pan-African family, a global African family, and they agree that Mama Louise Langdon Little is their mother too. So though they can't be here in person, they sent their words to let you know that global Africa sees you, Grenada. This land of spice is spicy. Mama Louise Langdon Little was the allspice. When you say you're going to UK and you're going to the US looking for greener pastures, you're going to these places for your better education because you came from humble beginnings. A girl like me from Baltimore with dilapidated buildings all around, I come to this land and I see abundance. I see rich greatness. I see the mango trees and the nutmeg. She didn't come from humble beginnings. It was because she was from this soil of abundance that it didn't matter that they surrounded her house. She knew who she was, a daughter from this soil. It was in her blood, and that bloodline runs through you. And because she lent her time with us in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in Omaha, Nebraska, we get to call her our mother too. And we'll take her stories with us into Uganda and Tanzania and Gambia and Liberia. We will share your stories. And this monument, this living monument that we are building to her, it's not a building. It's these trees that stand tall. It's this soil. The monument is already here. It's in your faces. And I see it. I see the pride here in Grenada. I'm going to read a statement on behalf of President Bobi Wine out of Uganda. And it wouldn't be appropriate for me to do that without asking for some audience participation. So when I say people, you say power. People. People. When I say people, you say power. People. People. Because our struggle continues. You see, here in Grenada, you're black every day. You see black newscasters. You see black presidents. Black ministers of tourism and culture. So you sometimes forget. In this bubble, in this abundance, in this island of spice, that we are still at war with Eurocentric values that cloud our mind and judgment that live inside our heart. So this monument, this sacred ground is a blessing because it will be that reminder of our connection to each other. And so I'm proud to say these words on behalf of President Bobby Wine. He said that in 1964, Malcolm made two trips to Africa. He met African leaders, including Egypt's Nasser, Tanzania's Julius Nyerere, Kenya's Jomo Kenyatta, Uganda's Obote, Ghana's Nkrumah, Nigeria's Azikiwe, Guinea's Sekou Touré. Malcolm did that. Malcolm was so inspired by the Organization of African Unity that he launched the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the OAAU, in New York. And tomorrow's his birthday, May 19th, 1925. 100 years later, his mission is still alive and well in you, that he wanted to unite the Black diaspora beyond our geographical boundaries and the illusions of our divisions. Before Malcolm X could realize this vision, he was taken from us. But I was so glad to hear one of the speakers say that he lives on. A seed that planted, rooted, and grounded with the water, I shall not be moved. Uganda's National Unity Platform stands in support with you. They are here today to support your story's continuity across the African continent. My name is Kim Poole, and on behalf of the Teaching Artists Institute in 9 countries, 7 of which are on the continent of Africa, we pledge to take your spices, to build the real relationships of exchange, to erect the star line of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, to build these connections so that American Airlines is not the only flight once a day that flies onto that ramp that Maurice Bishop's legacy built for us. We pledge today to not see this monument as history that we remember, but as a reminder of our mission today. Again, my name is Kim Poole, and I too am a daughter of Mama Louise Langdon Little. Thank you for allowing me to grace this sacred ground.
How often have major media outlets questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken or President Biden and said, how would you feel if your son or daughter was blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers? Why don't you insist that Israel stop bombing or all of the weapons will be cut off? These are basic, logical questions, but when they are avoided, then we're getting this sort of parody of journalism, which is more stenography than anything else.
That's Norman Solomon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Norman Solomon on war and the media. In times of war, the corporate media play a salient role in shaping public opinion. There are worthy and unworthy victims. They neatly divide certain categories. Muslims, Arabs, and Iranians generally fall into that latter category, whereas Washington and its allies are worthy victims who deserve our support and empathy. The current phase of the Gaza war did not begin on October 7th, as the media repeat ad nauseum. But to dig into the underlying causes and provide context and history rarely occurs because it would undermine the dominant propaganda. Thus, the Nora O'Donnells, Wolf Blitzers, Lester Holtz, and other corporate news anchors don't question the embedded assumptions and simply mimic, with few exceptions, the dominant official line. Our guest today is Norman Solomon. He's a political commentator and media critic. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of RootsAction.org, an online activist group. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. I talked with him on October 11th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, you wrote War Made Invisible before the Israeli attack on Gaza in response to the events of October 7th. And then you've crucially have added an afterword. Talk about the ingredients of that and how things have evolved.
I thought a lot when I was working on the afterword about the Gaza war. I tried to grasp how the events after October 7th, 2023, have related to the basic themes of the initial book. After all, the title War Made Invisible might at first, you know, seem counterintuitive because the Gaza war got tremendous and has gotten to some degree still a significant amount of U.S. media coverage. But it became really clear that the quantity of coverage didn't mean that the war itself has been visible. After all, the realities of war are death, maiming, terror, and very little of that has come through the news media coverage of the Gaza war, I think for two basic reasons. One is the inherent limitations of journalism to convey what it's really like to have missiles and bombs coming at you and the carnage and the death and the suffering, the loss, the mourning, the grief. Very difficult for TV, radio, newspapers, scrolling on a screen to convey to us what that's like, you know, to be in a war zone. But the invisibility has really been compounded by the tremendous media bias that we've gotten from mainstream U.S. media outlets. It doesn't mean that occasionally there aren't breakthrough stories that will shatter the invisible shield that separates us from the realities of war. But the essence of propaganda is repetition. The code words, the catchphrases, the frame of reference, and the silences. So the invisibility of what has been going on now into its second year in Gaza, I think has been a huge factor in insulating, in numbing people in the United States from what is being done really, if not explicitly in our names, certainly with our tax dollars and with U.S. government support. And then there's the subtitle of the book, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And at first glance, the U.S. military machine is not directly involved with what's been going on in Gaza. But if you go under the surface, really, the Pentagon and the Israeli military are pretty much joined at the hip. There are occasional disagreements, sometimes even at top level, U.S. president, Israeli prime minister. But underneath that is a tremendous synergy, ways in which really the Israeli military is functionally an adjunct to the U.S. war machine. And so that is also very much hidden from the U.S. public. The bombs and missiles that have been falling and continue to fall in Gaza and now also more recently in Lebanon, they are directly, in most cases, coming from the United States.
You write in the afterword that the extreme decimation in Gaza was foreshadowed from the outset. Explain what you mean.
Within the hours after October 7th, as the reporting came in, top Israeli officials said that we're going to shut down Gaza. No food, no medicine, nothing is going to get in. This was a magnification, a great acceleration of policy that has been in place for decades, where Israel has restricted what can go in, what can come out of Gaza, what's been called the largest open-air prison in the world. Some people say, well, not a great analogy since the people inside the open-air prison have done nothing really wrong. The vast majority of them simply civilians. In any case, in this instance, the gauntlet that was thrown down by Israeli leaders within hours of the news about the crimes of October 7th really did foreshadow what was coming up, because It was basically a declaration of war, primarily on the civilians. After all, the UN has documented that the deaths in Gaza because of the ongoing Israeli assault are overwhelmingly children and women. And it was an attitude from the Israeli government proclaimed that we simply will not have any compunction about decimating Gaza. And in fact, that's what has happened. The documentation is pretty clear now that certainly in this century, the speed and rate of slaughter of children and women in Gaza is unprecedented.
I don't like to use the term defense minister, but I guess I have to. The Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, said, "We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly." This is very interesting terminology. I mean, you might know that I have a background in, I'm Armenian and my family went through a genocide. And one of the key components of that Turkish genocide in 1915 was the dehumanization and the demonization of the Armenians. And they were called, all kinds of names, talked about in disparaging terms as animals, disease-ridden, etc. And it seems to be part and parcel of what happened. And again, the Germans did it during the Holocaust vis-a-vis Jews, gypsies, communists, socialists, demonization and dehumanization, core ingredients of genocide.
David, as you made that, I think, very profound point about the objectification of people in order to rationalize genocide, I was thinking of a quote that actually begins War Made Invisible from Aldous Huxley, which he uttered and in an awful way foreshadowed what was to come in the following few years. Huxley said, "The propagandist's purpose is to make one set of people forget that certain other sets of people are human. And once that bridge is crossed, then all kinds of atrocities are possible." The very conceit that news media are conveying to us what war is really all about is part of the numbing process. Because if we really believe that we understand what is going on, for instance, in Gaza, because we watch TV, listen to National Public Radio, whatever, through the mainstream media, then we're subjecting ourselves to a delusion that further insulates us from what war really is. And that makes supporting or at least accepting the war more possible.
You're right in the afterword, something about happened earlier this year. I'm quoting now, "The United States cast the only vote in the UN Security Council against the resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, the third time that the U.S. voted to block such a resolution. It was, you continue, yet another move to serve as the main enabler for Israel's mass murder of Palestinian people. The cruelty and magnitude of the slaughter were abhorrent to anyone not somehow numb to the human agony. Such numbing has been widespread in the United States. Some factors," you write, "include ethnocentric, racial, and religious biases against Arabs and Muslims." Talk about that a little bit.
The images come from Hollywood, from the language of mainstream pundits, from the imagery of news media, and also what's left out, the silences, the omissions, the lack of conveying the humanity of people, because at the one level, they simply are different than us, but more than that, they've been vilified through stereotypes and so forth. I have to say, when you look at the brilliant work of Edward Said over a period of many decades, how did people in the United States learn of what he had to say? Well, to a significant degree, it was if they listened to alternative radio. I mean, this is a radio program that has been able, willing to convey the voices of Edward Said, of Noam Chomsky, of others who, going back several decades, were willing to articulate on their basis of their scholarship and their humanity how these stereotypes and cliches and really vicious characterizations of Arab Muslim people are completely absurd if they're measured up against our common humanity. And I think that today, especially younger people, are shedding that kind of delusionary separation between different people on the planet based on their usual ethnocentric divisions that are exploited, created, magnified by the news media and politics of the country. And it's very discouraging to me, but I think we do need to name it, that although younger people in this country have often, because of their access to other forms of communication about Gaza events through social media and online and so forth, have gotten increasingly wise to the cruelty and really the human disconnection that has dominated mass media and politics. When you go into the mass media and politics of the country, there has been only a very slow improvement in this status quo baseline that has really enabled Israel to continue to inflict ethnic cleansing on Palestinian people, now overt mass murder in Gaza, and by most definitions, genocide.
You write about, I'm quoting, the brawny arms of the Israel lobby. Talk about that. We hear the acronym APEC quite a bit, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the major U.S.-based pro-Israel lobby, which spent millions of dollars to defeat Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman. They were both running for the House of Representatives, seeking re-election, and they were defeated with millions of dollars from AIPAC to ensure that defeat.
AIPAC is really playing now in a huge way in the electoral arena. They didn't used to do it so overtly. And as you mentioned, both Jamal Bowman in Bronx and Westchester in New York, and then Cori Bush in St. Louis were defeated not by grassroots opposition in their districts, but by these huge quantities, many, many millions of dollars of advertising and attacks. I think parallel to those kind of electoral efforts are the 24/7, 365 efforts by outlets like ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which I think with Truth in Packaging should be called the Defamation League against Palestinians, because that's what has been one of the main missions of ADL for a very long time. And it has cranked up since last spring. So many campuses went into upheaval in opposition to the continued U.S. government support for genocide against Palestinian people in Gaza, and demanding that their colleges sever any support or financial investments that are helping Israel to continue with its policies. And ADL and Aligned Forces really just went into overdrive, smearing the protesters as anti-Semitic, which, of course, is ironic given that so many leaders of those protests were Jewish themselves, as I happen to be. And so this is an effort to ratchet up the scam that has had tremendous propaganda impact in this country and has increased in terms of its intensity since October 7th, 2023, where the Israeli government perpetrating these ongoing crimes of occupation, of ethnic cleansing, now of really genocide in Gaza, that government wraps itself in Judaism. And then criticism of the actions of that government are then labeled and denounced as anti-Semitic. And I think it's notable that although there has been some pushback increasing from the grassroots and even in U.S. mass media on that technique, it still is dominant, it still is reflexive, and it has enormous salience, or at least impact, coming from mass media.
As you alluded to, among critics of Israel and U.S. Mideast policy, are many Jews. You are Jewish, as are Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, Jeff Cohen, Naomi Klein, Medea Benjamin, Norman Finkelstein, and many others. The Jewish Voice for Peace on and off campus has been very prominent in protests and demonstrations. But that establishment-oriented organizations of American Jews have a much louder presence and influence. How to counteract that louder presence and influence?
Really, we have, I think, the necessity, certainly the opportunity, to say that we need a single standard of human rights, that it's a basic question of human equality, and that we can't, we certainly shouldn't, pick and choose and say, oh, now we have this precept of what human rights are and should be, and then we just cast it aside. We don't accept the Orwellian notion, the doublethink, that says that you take an idea and you take it off the shelf and utilize it only when it's convenient, and then you put it back on the shelf when it becomes inconvenient. The fact is that Israel has been and is more than ever an apartheid state, and there was a huge transformation in U.S. society during the last several decades where acceptance of apartheid South Africa, largely because of protests and upheaval on college campuses and elsewhere in the 1980s, support for apartheid South Africa became unacceptable. And gradually, U.S. policy shifted out of necessity because the facts on the ground, so to speak, became such that apartheid in South Africa became untenable. Reality is that Israel as an apartheid state gets away with it because in U.S. media and politics, overwhelmingly, it's not acknowledged to be an apartheid state. And yet the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they all have come out with unequivocal reports that Israel is an apartheid state.
You write, melding Israel with Judaism is a core distortion that enables defenders of Israeli actions to cry anti-Semitism. Explain.
It's really been, I think, in a macabre way, a brilliant strategy that has been in effect for so many decades, and especially after the foundation of Israel, Zionism became, sometimes reluctantly by mainstream Jewish organizations in the U.S., seen to be necessary. There was substantial Jewish organized and unorganized Jewish opposition to Zionism, to the idea that Israel is necessary to have a quote-unquote Jewish state. But once it became a fait accompli, and then especially after the 1967 war, more and more the organized Jewish organizations with power in the U.S. basically became an adjunct to the Israeli propaganda machine. Recently, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to the United States and met with Jewish organizations, their leaderships, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, assured Netanyahu that ADL was committed to working very, very closely with the Israeli government to get its message out. And the message in all sorts of permutations is that Israel is the Jewish faith, and that if you are going to raise questions about Israel's behavior, its public policy, its military actions, that you somehow are falling into a trap of anti-Semitism. I write in the book about the cover story that Time magazine wrote just a few months after the Israeli assault began in Gaza, and it had a Jewish star filling the front cover. And keep in mind, this is the largest news weekly circulation in the United States. And the headline in the middle of the Jewish star was "The New Anti-Semitism." And this is, among other things, an assault on groups, including Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, led by Jews. saying that essentially criticism of Israel is an assault on Judaism itself. And so it gets, I want to say weird, but it's actually from a propaganda standpoint, very logical, because it's worked in the past. It's seen as a winning combination of various messages sort of braided together. And so the net effect, for instance, with this huge cover story in Time magazine, was to tell the readers that because of the Holocaust, Jews running the Israeli government and Israel itself should get a pass, get out of jail card, so to speak. Whereas if you had the single standard of human rights and you apply it to Israel, then you would have to condemn the apartheid system. You'd need to condemn ethnic cleansing.
You know, there are some really good independent sources of information. I'm thinking right now of The Intercept, which somehow got its hands on an internal memo circulating at the New York Times, where journalists were to avoid using the terms, I'm quoting here, genocide, ethnic cleansing, refugee camps, occupied territory, and even further discouraging referring to Palestine as Palestine whatsoever. In addition, the memo claims that words like slaughter, massacre, and carnage are too emotional to describe Israel's bombardment of Gaza. What do you think of all of that?
That's really illuminating. And here's a very poignant fact in that context. When the Intercept news site did a rigorous study of the first 6 weeks of the Gaza war and looked at the content of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, they found that the word slaughter was used to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis. It was used 60 different times. And that same word, slaughter, was used only once in describing what Israel had done to Palestinian people. And then you go to the word massacre. In that six-week period, those three media outlets used the word massacre 125 times to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis, and used the word massacre a grand total of two times to describe what Israel was doing and had been doing to people in Gaza. And that even understates the disparity of regard for the humanity of Israelis versus Palestinians, because by that point, in the first 6 weeks, many more Palestinians had been killed than those had been killed, than Israelis had been killed by people in Hamas. So I think this is, if you will, a numerical quantification of the regard that these leading, very influential U.S. media outlets have for the humanity of Israelis compared to Palestinians. We really have a numerical, not only anecdotal, but empirical way to measure the inhumanity of our own major media outlets. And there is this sort of circular relationship between people in the White House and on Capitol Hill on the one hand, and media on the other, because the mainline media and the top politicians are walking, if not in lockstep, then in very close proximity. They take nods from each other. They are acutely aware of what is defined as the reasonable bounds of discussion. We have the disparity here that is so extreme that it amounts to the dehumanization of certain people. I describe it as two levels of grief, where conveyed overtly and more subtly, the suffering, the mourning, the sense of loss, the humanity of some people is conveyed very viscerally, very emotionally and empathetically for certain people, Americans, countries where designated allies of the United States are in charge. And then there's the flip side, the dehumanization. One contrast that I think in contemporary times is really simultaneous, and that is the U.S. media coverage of the suffering in Ukraine. as a result of the really illegal and immoral Russian invasion and war on Ukraine. And there's been a tremendous quantity of human interest stories, of empathy, of outrage in terms of U.S. media coverage of what has been going on, the bombing of hospitals, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, the deaths and suffering in Ukraine. And when you contrast it to the equivocal kind of coverage that has been only occasional in terms of actually conveying the individual, the personal lives of people in Palestine, it's quite striking. Even then, when you look at, and there have been some good stories, some empathetic stories about individuals, families in Palestine, it is what Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky have described as victims without victimizers. So the indirection is what's conveyed in terms of Israeli culpability. Yes, Israel clearly drops the bombs. U.S. media coverage is sometimes critical of them doing it, but the benefit of the doubt is often given, routinely given, that, well, it's not that they're intentionally killing the Palestinian civilians, but they're being really careless. They're engaged in disregard and being sloppy about it, not really taking the kind of care that they should. And even less culpability is ascribed to Washington. And it's really talked about in U.S. media that this slaughter going on in Gaza would be really impossible without the U.S. arms shipments and the pipeline that continues. And I've thought a lot about the continuity of propaganda assumptions, which are often the most pernicious. And I could mention just a few really quickly, where the pattern set after 9/11 with the so-called war on terror have really been very entrenched in terms of U.S. media and politics with what Israel is doing in Gaza and how the media and political power structures in the United States really evade, elide, dodge the U.S. role in what really is a genocide. For instance, the mainstream discourse really avoids voices that condemn the U.S. government for its role. The U.S. allies usually just bypass accountability for the high-tech atrocities committed from the air. And that's a key point, because somehow we're acculturated. If the U.S. or U.S. ally kills people from high in the air, you know, we're above it all. It's maybe unfortunate mistakes are made. It can be criticized, but it's not really crude and barbarian like those who don't have high-tech missiles to inflict their atrocities, usually, frankly, on a smaller scale than what the high-tech Israeli military or U.S. military are doing. And the civilian deaths in Gaza are just portrayed as unintended, which again is really emblematic of how the U.S. media have portrayed the killing that the U.S. government has been engaged in ever since October 2001 with the invasion of Afghanistan, and sometimes not visible to U.S. media at all, the ongoing war on terror that continues to this day.
You're listening to Norman Solomon on War and the Media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. Israel has banned journalists from Gaza. Al Jazeera has been banned from reporting altogether from Israel and the occupied territories. Where are the words of protest from the icons of the liberal press, such as David Ignatius, Thomas Friedman, David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, and others? Where is CNN's Wolf Blitzer, who has a daily Situation Room program on CNN? And by the way, he once worked for AIPAC. Or Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic and host of PBS's Washington Week, who actually served in the Israeli army.
Yeah, the double standard is just so extreme, where when some enemy state imprisons or kills journalists, there are howls of outrage from U.S. mainstream media, as there should be. But we don't hear anywhere near that kind of outrage when, in the case of Israel, well-documented, the Israeli government intentionally targets and kills journalists. And that has been really in play in Gaza, where well over 100 journalists have been killed by Israel since October 7, 2023. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, based in New York, which is very much a mainstream institution, has said point blank that Israel has been killing journalists intentionally. And when you think about it, when crimes are being committed by the Israeli government, of course the Israeli government wants to close the eyes of the world. That could document, could portray, could convey what's really going on.
Talk more about war and the media. And I'm thinking of the robotic mantra that is repeated endlessly. The war started on October 7th. Most recently, I've heard it on Morning Edition from National Public Radio. Andrea Mitchell, being interviewed by Dana Bash on CNN, said the same thing. The war started on October 7th. So there's no history. There's no context. There's no background.
History begins when we say it began. That's really the underlying precept. We get to say when meaningful events started. And in this case, when 700,000 Palestinian people were expelled from their homes, from their villages, from their homeland in 1948 with the creation of Israel, that doesn't count. When the occupation, illegal since 1967, has gone on in the West Bank, in Gaza, that doesn't count. When the